Welcome to the Georgia Today podcast. Here we bring you the latest reports from the GPB newsroom. On today's episode, Georgia politicians react to the U.S. military's capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene is stepping down today. And Georgia hospital staff say the current flu season is a lot busier than usual.
We see anywhere between 120 and 150 patients on normal days. Instead of tapering down, we just are more consistent across the entire week.
Today is Monday, January 5th. I'm Peter Biello, and this is Georgia Today. Georgia leaders are responding along partisan lines to the U.S. military-backed capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. U.S. Senator Raphael Warnock echoed Democratic concerns that the move threatens to bring more violence and instability to Venezuela. U.S. House member Buddy Carter echoed Republican sentiment, hailing the apprehension of what he called an illegitimate leader. GPB's Sarah Callis reports on the reaction among Venezuelan Americans living in Georgia.
Israel Mendina was born in Venezuela, but left the country in 2006 when he was 28, out of fear of political persecution. He's now living in Georgia and says Maduro's arrest felt like a new Independence Day.
The Venezuelan people was not able to take this guy out. And you really need a bigger muscle that only countries like U.S. can do for us.
Not everyone celebrated the military action in Venezuela. Some critics held protests against the strikes in Atlanta on Saturday and questioned the legality of the operation. For GPB News, I'm Sarah Callis.
Marjorie Taylor Greene is leaving Capitol Hill today in the middle of her third term. She represented Northwest Georgia for 5 years and became one of the most well-known members of Congress, in part for amplifying conspiracy theories. As she heads for the exit, there is little consensus among her supporters on whether the conflict-laden headlines she generated were worth it. Greene's strongest supporters stand by her, despite her break with President Donald Trump. They see her as a fighter who spoke for them. Others in Greene's district say her style of politics did nothing to help the people she represented. Influenza deaths have ticked up. That's according to the latest numbers from Georgia's Department of Public Health. Providers say they'll likely see another surge in cases as holiday celebrations wind down. GPB's Sophie Gratis has more.
7 people died from the flu between December 20th and 27th in Georgia, bringing the total number of flu-associated deaths this season up to 29, compared to 0 this time last year. This year's most common strain, subclade K, causes typical symptoms like fatigue and fever, but can leave people slightly sicker. In Piedmont Macon Medical Center's emergency room, medical director Christopher Hogan says their numbers of sick patients defy weekly trends.
We see anywhere between 120 and 150 patients on normal days. Instead of tapering down, we just are more consistent across the entire week.
Nationally, Georgia enters 2026 among the highest for flu hospitalizations. Other respiratory illnesses like COVID and RSV have largely been left out of the surge, with months of flu season to come. For GPB News, I'm Sophie Gratis.
An ash sample collected in the weeks after the 2024 Biolab fire in Conyers contained chromium. The normally harmless element occurs naturally in some soils. That can change when it burns. Despite warnings, later testing approved by the state did not look for it. GPB's Pamela Kirkland reports.
Recently obtained emails showed Georgia's Environmental Protection Division warned extreme heat from the Biolab fire could have transformed relatively harmless chromium into hexavalent chromium, a known carcinogen. In an internal email, a state risk assessor recommended that any future samples be tested specifically for the toxic form of chromium. But this August, a cleanup plan submitted by a contractor for Biolab excluded hexavalent chromium from testing, saying it was, quote, highly unlikely to be found. The plan was later approved by Georgia EPD. Dr. Ted Shetler, director of the nonprofit Science and Environmental Health Network, says that decision is hard to defend.
You almost should be assuming that a lot of that would be chromium 6 because there was a fire there and because it was that kind of fire with all these oxidizing chemicals.
Chromium did not appear in any updates or response summaries reviewed by GPB News. Neither the Georgia EPD nor Biolab responded to GPB's request for comment. For GPB News, I'm Pamela Kirkland.
State wildlife officials say 15 right whale calves have been born so far this season. The Georgia Department of Natural Resources reported on Saturday that the last five calves spotted across the endangered species calving area were sighted off the coast of Georgia. The most recent spotting was 2 days after Christmas, about 7 miles east of Blackbeard Island. That's according to NOAA Fisheries. And according to the New England Aquarium, 15 calves exceeds last year's total of 11. NOAA says at least 50 calves are needed each season to stop the species' decline. The season lasts from November through April, and the calving area is off the coast from North Carolina to Florida. Only about 70 reproductively active females remain among a population of less than 400 right whales. The species is endangered by entanglements, vessel strike injuries, and changes in prey availability because of climate change. Georgia-born writer John T. Edge has been telling stories about the South and its food for three decades. From leading the Southern Foodways Alliance to hosting television's True South and writing for numerous publications, he's connected the region's complex history with its cooks and kitchens. Now, in his latest book, House of Smoke, he turns his attention to his own story. His revealing memoir confronts uncomfortable truths and details the highs and lows in his personal life and amazing career in food media. John T. Edge spoke with GPB's Orlando Montoya.
After so many years of writing about others, why did you decide to write about yourself?
I mean, I can answer that a multitude of ways because the universe seemed to tell me I was supposed to be doing that. But one of the things I realized making True South, our television show, is that, you know, I would sit down with, let's say, the Dublin show we made. I sat down with two women in Dublin who were in recovery for addiction. And I sat on a park bench in Dublin, Georgia, with these two women, and they told me the darkest moments of their lives. And that became part of a show that we broadcast across the nation. And when I realized the depths of what people were sharing with me on camera as five filmmakers stared back at them with lenses pointed toward them, that I had a responsibility to reveal my own story to others. That's part of what drove me.
Of course, I write about other people every day, but I also keep my own writing about myself on my computer. And I think to myself, will it ever be used one day? But you got it out there. There's sort of a sense that you want your story to be told as well.
Yeah, Orlando, I used to think about memoir as kind of an act of selfishness. I really, like you, I enjoy writing about other people. I think that's what I'm good at, quite frankly. But writing this book, and I wrote a magazine piece about 7 years ago called My Mother's Catfish Stew. I used to write a column for the Oxford American magazine, and I wrote that magazine piece in a way to reconcile with my mother, who died 11 days before our son was born. I wrote that magazine piece to introduce our son to my mother, whom he never knew, as he was going off to college. And when they read that magazine piece, people came up to me and said things like, you know, I grew up in Texas and my mother's drug of choice was barbiturates, but I understand your story. I can see some of my own story in your story. And that convinced me that maybe this memoir I might write wouldn't be selfish, but might be generous. And I hope that's the way people read it, because that's what I intend.
For two decades, you led the Southern Foodways Alliance. You were with the organization from before its beginning. What did you see as its mission, and how did you and the organization advance it?
Well, I was inspired by John Edgerton's writing. John lived most of his life in Nashville, wrote two big books, Speak Now Against the Day, about the generation before the civil rights movement in the South, and then another book called Southern Food at Home, on the Road, and in History. And the idea that civil rights and food culture might have something to say to each other, we borrowed from John. And I took it as my mission, and we at the Southern Foodways Alliance took it as our larger mission to tell the stories of people whose stories had gone untold, the cooks and farmers and servers who fed the South to kind of pay down debts of pleasure owed to previous generations. And that meant conducting oral histories, making films, The Southern Viewways Alliance by now has made over, collected over 1,000 oral histories and made over 100 films. And also meant publishing a journal, a podcast called Gravy. All that work continues today, but all of it was this attempt to reconcile the South, a place riven by the Civil War, and then a place not quite reconciled by the efforts of brave people in the Civil Rights Movement.
You write that race, class, and these other issues are very key to understanding the South story, including the biscuits and the fried chicken and all of it.
Yeah.
Why do you take that approach? What is it about that approach that is the right way to go?
I think that, you know, food is an elemental expression of people in place. You know, it is comparable to the literature that we make that emerges from the American South. It is comparable to the music that we make in the South. It is this honest expression that springs from this soil. And I think by studying food, we can get at all of those things. We can get at race, class, ethnicity, identity. And I think because, you know, I think if you focus upon working class food, the food that sustains the great majority of us, my interest was, you know, in paying attention to those working class cooks, and less in the recipe writing and more in the documentation of lives.
Your tenure at the Southern Foodways Alliance was brought to an abrupt end in 2020. This was a painful chapter to read because it seemed like everything you worked for suddenly came into question. Your allies became your enemies, and it was, in your words, like a horrible car wreck. Briefly, what happened?
So in 2020, remember that magazine piece I talked about, My Mother's Catfish Stew? In that moment, the James Beard Foundation, which awarded me their MFK Fisher Distinguished Writing Prize for that piece of magazine writing, asked me to engage in a webinar about what food writing can do and help us recognize about troubled families. And I said, oh, no, I choose instead, let's focus on this troubled American moment. This was 2020 after the murder of George Floyd. And in that moment, I said, I don't want to talk about what food writing has to do with complicated families. I want to focus on this complicated American moment. And in doing that, I exposed my own hubris and made me the story instead of the deeper story that was there. And that begins a moment when people challenge my stance in this world. Was it an appropriate moment for me to leave? Yes. I'd been in my job 20 plus years. And, you know, if I'm being self-critical, I think the thing I didn't recognize in that moment is the good I could do beyond the job I held in that moment. I didn't have enough vision to see something, what might come next for me and how a new generation of writers and thinkers were changing the narrative about Southern food. I don't know. I lacked a vision in that moment, and I paid for it.
That's food writer John T. Edge, founding director of the Southern Foodways Alliance, writer in residence at the University of Mississippi, writer instructor at the University of Georgia, and host of SEC Network and ESPN's True South, among other titles. His memoir is House of Smoke. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, sir.
You can watch or listen to me in Orlando discuss that book on GPB's Narrative Edge. That's our podcast and video series about Georgia writers and Georgia stories. Find Narrative Edge on YouTube or your favorite podcast app. Delta Airlines has opened a hospitality space in the Las Vegas Sphere. The Nevada Entertainment Company today announced a partnership with the Atlanta-based airline that includes a Delta 360 Club inside the iconic venue. In sports, the Atlanta Falcons have fired coach Raheem Morris and general manager Terry Fontenot. The team announced the moves hours after completing its eighth consecutive losing season on Sunday. Owner Arthur Blank said last night he has, quote, great personal affinity for Morris and Fontenot, but he believes a change is needed. He clarified today that those moves were just the beginning of a leadership sweep. He also announced a new president of football. And that's all the news fit to podcast today. Thank you so much for tuning in to Georgia Today. We know you have a lot of choices. We appreciate you choosing GPB. If you want to learn more about any of the stories you heard on the podcast today, just check out our website, gpb.org/news. Our reporters are always posting news stories there. And if you haven't subscribed to this podcast yet, hit subscribe now. We've got a lot of news coming your way this legislative session, which begins next week. If you've got feedback on the stories you heard today or would like to let us know about a story you think we should be covering, send us an email. The address is georgiatoday@gpb.org. I'm Peter Biello. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.